Israel had. He expelled its representatives and became its avowed enemy. He agreed to host the hijackers and their hostages at Entebbe, 2,200 miles from Israel. Hadad believed that Israel would have no alternative but to negotiate with him. In Entebbe, his operatives released the 209 non-Israeli and non-Jewish passengers and the 12 Air France crew, though the crew, in a courageous act of solidarity, insisted on staying with the remaining 83 Israeli and 8 non-Israeli Jewish passengers. The hijackers then demanded the release of 53 freedom fighters in exchange for the Israeli and Jewish hostages. This demand came via Idi Amin, who made telephone contact with Israel himself. The list of freedom fighters included Archbishop Hilarion Capucci, a man of the cloth who had used his diplomatic status to smuggle a large shipment of weaponry in his Mercedes sedan to Fatah cells in Jerusalem. Kozo Okamoto, one of the perpetrators of the 1972 Lod Airport massacre, and the 5 terrorists who had been on the Nairobi mission, who Hadad was sure were in Kenyan or Israeli hands. The Mossad was in turmoil. There were now many who regretted that the Nairobi 5 had not been dumped into the sea. At a command meeting, Safrir said, "They want the 5? With pleasure. Let's fly them to Uganda and drop them from the plane onto the roof of the terminal, so Hadad will realize that that's all he is going to get from us." Meanwhile, the IDF planned a rescue operation involving a huge force that would land in the area of Lake Victoria and secure the whole airport and a wide swath of land around it. Rabin listened to the plan, growing angrier by the minute. "In the time that it takes to secure the whole area, the hijackers will slaughter all the hostages, and Idi Amin will have time to bring in reinforcements," he fumed. Rabin told the IDF that he wanted to see a plan in which no more than 3 minutes would elapse from the moment forces land until the rescue operation begins, said the Director General of the Prime Minister's Office, Amos Eran. But from such a distance, without any intelligence, this seemed an impossible request. Lacking any viable alternatives, Rabin was inclined to comply with the hijackers' demands. Though he loathed the idea, he saw no other way to save the 100-plus innocent lives. But this action would entail a breach of the ironclad law laid down by Golda Meir and accepted thereafter as Israeli policy. No negotiations with terrorists. Shin Bet Director Avraham Ahituv demanded that, if there truly was no other way, then, at the very least, no prisoners with blood on their hands, a phrase that has since been invoked repeatedly in similar situations, should be exchanged for hostages. In other words, only junior PLO functionaries who had not been directly involved in spilling Israeli blood could be considered for release. "Anyone who has killed a Jew," said Ahituv, "must either be eliminated or die in an Israeli prison after being sentenced to life." For 4 days, the debate continued. Demonstrations by relatives of the hostages raged outside the gates to the Kirya, within earshot of Rabin's office. The daughter of the director of Israel's main nuclear reactor was one of the hostages. He had access to Rabin and exerted heavy pressure on him to reach a compromise with the terrorists. If all that wasn't enough, Rabin then received a secret report from the Military Censorship Bureau that it had barred the publication, in an Israeli daily newspaper, of a story that included all the details of Operation Heartburn. Ahituv informed Rabin that he had ordered the reporter's phone to be tapped, but had still not managed to determine the source of the leak. Rabin was furious. "I am really shocked that it is impossible in this country to take a military correspondent and lock him up and grill him about where he got it from. This leakage of information is going to be a disaster for us." Rabin understood that breaking Israel's promise to Kenyatta of total secrecy about the Nairobi Five would lead to a crisis in their relationship with Kenya. More important, disclosure of the affair could paint Israel, which was now asking for the world's support against the hijackers, as a pirate state, employing terrorist-like methods. On the other hand, how could Israel negotiate with the terrorists when both they and Kenya denied having any knowledge of their whereabouts? In the end, Caesarea came up with a solution that didn't require a hostage-for-prisoner swap. 5 years earlier, Harari had decided that he needed an operative who could pose as a pilot. Why exactly? Because perhaps we'll need it one day, was his customary answer to any questions about preparations he'd made without any immediate cause. He persuaded Zamir to make the financial investment, and an operative codenamed David underwent the lengthy training in Israel and Europe. Now the investment paid off, big time. David rented a plane in Kenya and circled the Entebbe terminals and tarmac, taking photographs from the air. When he landed, he posed as a wealthy, pampered English hunter living in a Central African country who needed the assistance of the control tower on a number of matters. Ugandan air controllers cooperated willingly and even had a drink with him, sharing their impressions of the big mess of the last few days, their term for the hostage situation in the nearby terminal. 12 hours later, when Harari brought David's detailed report and the hundreds of photos he had taken to Rabin, the Prime Minister's face lit up. "This is just what I needed," he said. "This is the intelligence for an operation." Especially important to Rabin were the shots of Ugandan soldiers all around the terminal, which he took as proof that Wadi Haddad's men hadn't booby-trapped the building. "Idi Amin wouldn't have allowed his men to be there," he said. It was also clear from the pictures that the Ugandan force guarding the terminal was very small. Sayeret Matkal came up with an original and daring plan. A small Sayeret contingent would land, under cover of darkness, in an unmarked C-130 Hercules military transport aircraft, using the runway lights that were lit for a civilian cargo plane scheduled to land before it. The force would disembark and travel toward the terminal in a number of vehicles behind a black Mercedes, similar to the one used by Idi Amin, in order to confuse the Ugandan guards. Close to the terminal, the force would dismount and storm the building from several different entryways, taking advantage of the surprise and confusion to eliminate the terrorists. All of this was supposed to be accomplished in less than 2 minutes. More IDF forces would land immediately afterward and would deal with the control tower, the Ugandan soldiers, and the Ugandan Air Force jets, so that they would not be able to pursue the Israeli planes once they took off with the hostages and troops aboard. Kenyatta agreed to allow the Israeli aircraft to land in Nairobi to refuel on the way back. Defense Minister Shimon Peres believed that the plan could succeed, and he pressed Rabin. On July 3, the Prime Minister gave the green light for the raid. The commanders of the operation asked Rabin what to do if they ran into Amin himself. "If he interferes, the orders are to kill him," Rabin said. To which the foreign minister, Yigal Alon, added, "Even if he doesn't interfere." The Israeli task force set out for the mission on 4 planes. Each soldier was given a map of Uganda and a sum of money in American dollars, in case they were stranded and had to escape on their own. But it was clear to us that this was mere talk, and that in fact this was an operation without a getaway plan. If something were to go wrong, we'd be stuck there and would have to fight to the death, said Yiftach Reicher, the deputy to Yonatan Netanyahu, brother of Benjamin and now commander of Sayeret Matkal. The first Hercules landed as planned. Reicher, who was in one of the Land Rovers following the black Mercedes, recalled the scene. There was total silence and total darkness, blacker than black, in the huge deserted airfield. Wide runways with nobody moving on them. All I thought to myself was, "Mommy, this is scary." The element of surprise was almost lost when the force encountered 2 Ugandan guards and Netanyahu decided that they constituted a danger and opened fire at them with a pistol fitted with a silencer. The soldiers were not killed by the shots, and the man sitting behind Netanyahu, believing they were still dangerous, shot them with his unsilenced rifle. The sound of the rifle brought other Ugandan troops to the area, and a firefight began. The Israelis' vehicles reached the terminal and the charge began, but Netanyahu was hit, and he later died of his wounds. However, the terrorists were taken by surprise when the raiding party, headed by Muki Betzer, broke into the terminal, and he killed all of them before they could get organized. Reicher's force broke into an adjoining building manned by Ugandan troops and killed them, too. Another detail seized the control tower. Another destroyed 8 Ugandan Air Force MiG fighters parked on the runway. All 8 hijackers had been killed. 3 of the hostages, caught in the crossfire, also died. Another hostage, an elderly Israeli woman who had been taken to the hospital the previous night, was murdered, on Amin's instructions, in retaliation for the raid. But 100 people had been rescued, and Israel had made no concessions. The operation became a model for how to handle hostage situations. No negotiation and no compromise with terrorists, but a steadfast willingness to go to extraordinary lengths and even to risk lives in order to free hostages. But though the raid on Entebbe was a significant tactical victory, the man who'd ordered the hijacking, the man Golda Meir had signed a kill order on more than 6 years earlier, the terrorist who'd been only slightly wounded by a barrage of RPGs fired through his Beirut office window, the zealot who'd survived a bomb dropped on a Beirut stadium in 1974, who topped Israel's hit list, and who was the target of a number of assassination plans still on the drawing boards, was still alive and still at large. Rabin told the Mossad to spare no expense. Wadi Hadad must die. Chapter 13. Death in the Toothpaste. In May 1977, Israel's Labor Party, which had ruled the country since its establishment in 1948, lost a national election for the first time. It was defeated by the Likud, a nationalist right-wing party led by Menachem Begin, the former commander of the Irgun, the anti-British underground. A combination of various factors, the discrimination and humiliation suffered by Jewish immigrants from Arab countries, revelations of corruption in the Labor Party, the shortcomings of the Yom Kippur War, and the ability of the charismatic Begin to take advantage of these factors and ride a wave of populism, led to an upset that shocked both Israelis and observers abroad. Begin was viewed by many foreign leaders and local top officials as an extremist and a warmonger. Some of the chiefs of Israel's military and intelligence agencies were convinced that they would soon be replaced by partisans of the new government. But Begin's initial moves as prime minister surprised everyone, foreign and domestic. At a dramatic summit meeting with Presidents Jimmy Carter and Anwar Sadat at Camp David in 1978, he agreed to a breakthrough peace treaty with Egypt that provided for Israel's eventual total pullout from the Sinai Peninsula, conquered from Egypt in 1967. The withdrawal of the army, the dismantling of settlements, and the relinquishment of oil fields and tourism facilities were bitterly opposed by Israel's right wing. But Begin, risking his own political standing, forced his party to comply. He also greatly strengthened the security alliance with the United States and bolstered the overarching authority of the Israeli Supreme Court. Internally, there was no purge. Indeed, Begin even asked 2 men with strong ties to labor, Shin Bet chief Avraham Ahituv and Mossad head Yitzhak Hofi, to remain in their jobs. It was very strange for us, Hofi said. The Labor Party was hard-boiled and pragmatic when it came to matters of the military and intelligence. But for Begin, Hofi said, the army was something sacred. As a practical matter, that meant Begin gave the military and intelligence agencies carte blanche. He had been given very limited access to the intelligence community when he was leading the parliament opposition, and he had to be taught a great deal. But even after he'd been exposed to the nuts and bolts, his oversight was superficial at best. It was as if he was hovering above us at 80,000 feet, said Mossad Deputy Chief Nahum Admoni. Begin signed off without question on all of the red page targeted killing orders that the Mossad submitted to him. The Prime Minister did not even insist on the standard operating procedure of having an aide transcribe meetings with the Mossad chief to approve sabotage and targeted killing operations. This surprised Hofi. Rabin, he said, would bring the issue to be approved before a kind of inner cabinet. But Begin signed off on operations face-to-face, without a stenographer and without his military aid. I advised him that it was important to put things in writing. The only point of disagreement between Begin and his intelligence chiefs was one of shading and priorities. At his first meeting with Hoffi, he said he wanted the Mossad to launch a large-scale targeted killing campaign against at-large Nazi war criminals. I told him, Hoffi said, Prime Minister, today the Mossad has other missions that concern the security of Israel now and in the future, and I give priority to today and tomorrow over yesterday. He understood that, but he didn't like it. In the end, we decided that we'd concentrate on one target, Josef Mengele. But Begin was a very emotional person, and he was disappointed. At the same time, though, Begin understood Hoffi's point. Unlike other Israelis who saw the Holocaust as a one-time historical catastrophe, said Shlomo Nachtimon, a prominent Israeli journalist who was close to Begin and served as his media advisor when he was prime minister, Begin believed with all his heart that the lesson of the Holocaust is that the Jewish people must protect themselves in their own country in order to prevent a renewed threat to their existence. Begin equated Yasser Arafat with Adolf Hitler, and believed that the Palestinian Covenant, which called for the destruction of the Jewish state, was nothing less than Mein Kampf too. We Jews and we Zionists, guided by experience, will not take the path taken by leaders in Europe and across the globe in the 30s, Begin said in a fulminating speech in the Knesset on July 9, 1979, attacking the West German and Austrian chancellors, Willy Brandt and Bruno Kreisky, for their ties to Yasser Arafat. We take Mein Kampf too seriously, and we shall do all we can, and with God's help we will be able, to prevent the realization of the horror uttered by that son of Satan, Arafat, the leader of a despicable organization of murderers, the likes of which has not existed since the Nazis. Since 1974, as terror attacks in Europe tapered off, Arafat had been putting special emphasis on political efforts in the international arena to obtain diplomatic recognition for the PLO and to present himself as someone who was ready to negotiate with Israel. Over Israel's vociferous objections, official and overt PLO diplomatic missions were opened all over the world, including in Europe. At the height of this campaign, in November 1974, Arafat appeared before the UN General Assembly and delivered a speech that generally was accepted as being relatively moderate. Moreover, Arafat's efforts to appear an advocate for a political solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict began a thaw in relations between the PLO and the United States. Israeli intelligence was deeply concerned about a potential rapprochement between its main ally and its chief enemy. A December 1974 paper prepared by Amman for then-Prime Minister Rabin warned that the United States has an interest in acquiring maximal influence inside the PLO so that it will not remain an exclusively Soviet stronghold. The paper also said, about Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who was considered pro-Israel, we do not find in his words an absolute negation of PLO with regard to the future. Israel's intelligence community wasn't persuaded by the PLO's diplomacy. To Amman, it was nothing more than a draft strategy for the liquidation of Israel. While Arafat wooed American diplomats and was toasted at the United Nations, his people were continuing to attack Israeli citizens. Arafat was the complete opposite of his ludicrous appearance. He was a kind of genius, said Major General Amos Gilad, long a prominent figure in military intelligence. He had two deputies for running terror operations, Abu Jihad and Abu Iyad, but, except in one attack, you won't find any direct connection to Arafat. It's like a zookeeper letting a hungry lion loose in the streets and it eats someone. Who's responsible, the lion? Clearly, it's the zookeeper. Abu Jihad got directives in principle, and he did the rest on his own. Arafat didn't want reports, didn't take part in planning meetings, didn't okay operations. Arafat's increased prominence on the world stage led to a sharp debate between the Mossad and Amman about whether he was still a suitable target for assassination. Brigadier General Yigal Pressler, then head of the Amman department that dealt with assassination targets, argued passionately that Arafat should be left at the top of the list. He is a terrorist. He has Jewish blood on his hands. He orders his people to keep on carrying out terror attacks. Everything must be done to get rid of him. The head of counterterror at the Mossad, Shimshon Yitzhaki, disagreed. After Arafat's speech at the UN, he has become a political figure. He's the head of the snake, but the world has given him legitimacy, and killing him will put Israel into an unnecessary political imbroglio. Ultimately, the latter opinion won the day. That meant that Arafat's name was removed from the kill list, and Wadi Haddad's name was pushed to the top. For 18 months after the Entebbe raid, Wadi Haddad lived securely and very affluently in Baghdad and Beirut. The Mossad was apprehensive about using firearms in Arab capitals such as Baghdad, Damascus, and Beirut, however, because the risk of capture was simply too great. And so more silent methods of assassination were sought, ones that had a less visible signature and made the death appear natural or accidental, the product of, say, a disease or a car crash. In such cases, even if there were to be a suspicion of foul play, by the time anything could be done, the killers would be long gone. Whereas in a hit using firearms, it is immediately clear that the killers are still in the vicinity. The Mossad decided to exploit its deep intelligence penetration of Haddad's organization and to allocate the job of eliminating him to Junction. The assassination, using poison, was assigned to the agent Sadness, who had a high degree of access to his home and office. On January 10, 1978, Sadness switched Haddad's toothpaste for an identical tube containing a lethal toxin, which had been developed after intense effort at the Israel Institute for Biological Research in Nes Ziona, southeast of Tel Aviv, one of the most closely guarded locations in Israel. It was founded in 1952 and still serves as the facility where Israel develops its top-secret defensive and offensive biological warfare agents. Each time Haddad brushed his teeth, a minute quantity of the deadly toxin penetrated the mucous membranes in his mouth and entered his bloodstream. The gradual accretion in his body, when it reached a critical mass, would be fatal. Haddad began feeling sick and was admitted to an Iraqi government hospital. He told the doctors there that in the middle of January he had begun suffering from severe abdominal spasms after a meal. His appetite faded, and he lost more than 25 pounds. He was first diagnosed as suffering from hepatitis and, later, a very bad cold. Doctors treated him with aggressive antibiotics, but his condition didn't improve. His hair began to fall out, and his fever spiked. The doctors in Baghdad were at a loss. They suspected that Haddad had been poisoned. Arafat instructed an aide to approach the Stasi, East Germany's secret service, to ask them for help. In the 1970s, the Stasi had provided Palestinian terror organizations with passports, intelligence, shelter, and weapons. The East German leader, Erich Honecker, and others in that country, regarded Arafat as a true revolutionary, like Fidel Castro, and were ready to help him. On March 19, 1978, Haddad was flown to the Regierungskrankenhaus in East Berlin, a prestigious hospital that catered to members of the intelligence and security communities. His aides packed a bag for him with his toiletries, including a tube of the deadly toothpaste. Intelligence material reaching the Mossad after he boarded the plane from Baghdad to Berlin gave cause for satisfaction. Haddad was absolutely finished when he reached Germany, read a report at a Junction command meeting. Biological Institute experts say he is a dead man walking. He was admitted under the pseudonym Ahmed Dukli, 41 years old, 5 feet 6 inches tall. He was indeed in bad condition, hemorrhaging in many places, including subcutaneously, from the pericardium around his heart, at the root of his tongue, his tonsils, his pleural membranes, and inside his cranium, with large quantities of blood in his urine. Bone marrow functioning was suppressed, with a resulting drop in the red platelet count in his blood. Despite his being treated as a privileged patient, Haddad's condition continued to deteriorate. The military physicians, the best doctors in East Germany, put their patient through every conceivable test, blood, urine, bone marrow, x-rays, They believed he had been poisoned, either with rat poison or some heavy metal, perhaps thallium, but they could find no physical evidence. According to information reaching Israel from an agent in East Germany, Haddad's screams of pain reverberated throughout the hospital, and the doctors gave him increasing doses of tranquilizers and sedatives. Wadi Haddad died in great agony in the East Berlin hospital on March 29, 10 days after he had arrived. Shortly afterward, Stasi chief Erich Mielke received a full report, including results of an autopsy conducted by Professor Otto Prokop of East Berlin's Humboldt University, one of the world's leading authorities on forensic medicine. He wrote that the immediate cause of death was brain bleeding and pneumonia by panmyelopathy, and that in view of the symptoms and the person under discussion, there was room for suspicion that someone had assassinated him. But in hair-splitting forensic medicalese, he was actually admitting that he had no idea what had killed Haddad. At the time of his death, Haddad was effectively in command of an entirely separate organization from that led by George Habash. But Habash grieved his comrade's demise, and he had no doubt that Israel was behind it. The Mossad and the leaders of the Israeli defense establishment were overjoyed at the operation's outcome. One of Israel's most potent and effective enemies had been neutralized. No less important, 5 years after the Lillehammer fiasco, the Mossad had returned to targeted killings, and had done so in an eminently sophisticated manner. This may have been the first time that the phrase low signature, to describe an assassination in which the death appears to be natural or by chance, entered the Mossad's vocabulary. "I was very happy when I heard Haddad was dead," said Shimshon Yitzhaki, "because Israel never admitted that it had killed Haddad," he stressed. "Don't take my words as confirmation of involvement in the case, but he declared that anyone who has Jewish blood on their hands is doomed to die. Without Haddad, incidentally, his organization couldn't exist. It was already functioning separately from George Habash, and it split between Haddad's deputies and then kept on splitting until it melted away." With Haddad eliminated, the Mossad moved on to its next target, Ali Hassan Salameh. The reason Salameh had to die are a matter of some dispute. Israeli intelligence believed he had planned and implemented the slaughter of the Israeli Olympic team in Munich, though people who worked with Salameh strongly deny this accusation. In any case, the desire to eliminate him was likely intensified by the fact that the attempt to assassinate him in Lillehammer had turned into the most embarrassing and damaging fiasco in the Mossad's history. Salameh himself poured oil on the flames by mocking the agency for botching the Norwegian operation. "When they killed Bouchiki, I was in Europe," Salameh said in an interview with the Lebanese Al-Sayad. "Bouchiki was a swimming pool employee. His face and figure did not match my description." Salameh said he was saved not so much because of my skills, but rather because of the weakness of Israeli intelligence. This interview was distributed to the heads of the intelligence community by the Amman department that deals with open sources intelligence. Harari had asked the unit to collect every detail it could about Salameh. "Do not fear," he told his people when the interview was read out at a Kasaria meeting. "His day will come." Salameh was undoubtedly connected to a number of acts of terrorism against both Israeli and Arab targets. He himself admitted involvement in Black September operations in the 2 interviews he gave, but Black September was not in existence anymore in 1978, and Salameh had taken on a number of internal roles in Fatah, leaving the terror activities to others. Was revenge for what he had done in the past a sufficient reason to take him out? "Killing Salameh was first and foremost a matter of closing the Munich account," said Yair Ravid, who was the commander of Unit 504's northern region and one of the top experts on PLO attacks originating in Lebanon. "In our view, he was not an initiator of terrorist attacks in the late 1970s. Other Qusayriya operatives of the time, however, insisted that Salameh remained a threat as a commander of the PLO's Force 17, Arafat's bodyguard unit. We've got to remember that Force 17 not only was guarding Arafat, but also carried out various terrorist operations, said one Caesarea veteran. But there was also a deeper motive. On July 10, 1978, during a high-level meeting at the Mossad, Caesarea chief Mike Harari reported that there had been significant progress made toward the goal of eliminating Salameh. But David Kimche, the head of Universe, Tevel, the Mossad branch in charge of relations with the intelligence agencies of other countries, said that his CIA counterparts had hinted that Salameh was an asset of theirs. They didn't say explicitly that they wanted to protect him, but this has to be on the table. And we have to ask ourselves whether our relations with Helga, the Mossad's nickname for the CIA, should alter our attitude toward him. Shimshon Yitzhaki responded sharply, "So what? Suppose he's connected to the Americans. This man has Jewish blood on his hands. He was involved in Munich. He's still operating against us. I don't give a damn if he's an American agent." In fact, Salameh was not just any source for the CIA. MJTRUST-2, as he was labeled by his controllers at Langley, was one of the CIA's most important contacts in the Middle East. Moreover, he was acting with the full knowledge and approval of Yasser Arafat, serving as the channel for exchanges between the Americans and the PLO. Dominic, a senior Mossad official involved in the hunt for Salameh, said that throughout the 1970s, the Mossad learned of the depth of the ties between the CIA and Salameh. The Mossad and Prime Ministers Rabin and Begin saw these ties as no less than base treachery on the part of an ally, a stab in the back. According to Kai Bird's The Good Spy, an authoritative biography of Robert C. Ames, one of the CIA's savviest field operatives in the Middle East, Salameh and Ames met for the first time in 1969 at the Strand Café in Beirut, and continued to meet later on in CIA safe houses in the same city. Ames reported to the CIA that Arafat valued Salameh highly. The PLO was officially considered a terrorist organization by the United States, but the CIA wanted to preserve a back channel. In 1973, with Kissinger's approval, this channel became a secret but formal link between the United States and Arafat. Over the years, the two met in Europe and Beirut many times. The connection continued even after Salameh took a leading role in Black September. The Americans persisted not because they disagreed with the Mossad's evaluation of Salameh's role and responsibility in terrorist activities, but in spite of that. Salameh even admitted to Ames that he had recruited Mohamed Boudia, the Paris theater owner who had sent agents to blow up a hotel in Israel, to Black September. Ames considered this to be interesting intelligence, and he even expressed sympathy for the Palestinian cause. "I am fully aware of the activities of our friend," he wrote in a letter to the intermediary who passed messages between him and Salameh, "and although I do not agree with all of them, I can sympathize with his organization's feeling that they must carry them out." Ames did all he could to persuade Salameh that "we are not out to get his organization. Contrary to his beliefs, we are not an action group like his group is." He also kept on reassuring him in order to keep the connection with him alive. "Our friend should know that he still has friends in high places, and so does his cause." The only point over which Ames saw fit to admonish Salameh was the possibility that Black September would act in the United States. His activities in Europe, which are fully documented, and his plans in our territory, which we know of completely and will hit hard and expose to his organization's embarrassment, are the only points on which we disagree. In other words, as long as Salameh would be careful not to harm Americans or act on American soil, he could continue attacking other targets without fear of reprisal from the United States. Ames even went so far as to offer, "I could arrange safe travel to a European point if he so desires." Through the Ames-Salameh middleman, a meeting between CIA Deputy Director Vernon Walters and top Fatah officials was arranged and held in Rabat, Morocco, on November 3, 1973. The understanding that existed between Ames and Salameh became an official position. Fatah would not harm Americans, and the secret channel of communication would remain open. Ames wasn't present when Salome traveled with Arafat to the General Assembly in New York in 1974, but he organized the visit and arranged meetings at the Waldorf Astoria. "We watched him escorting Arafat around New York," said Dominic. This was insulting, wounding, as if they had poked a finger in our eye. Salome, as Arafat's emissary, tried to obtain official American recognition of the PLO as the sole representative of the Palestinians. It didn't happen, but the very existence of the channel was a significant achievement from Arafat's point of view. In exchange, Salome helped Ames with various kinds of information about developments in Lebanon and in the PLO, and on attempts by the PLO's rivals to harm the United States. A deep friendship had formed between Ames and Salome, which, due to Ames's rising standing in the agency, was gradually affecting the U.S. administration's attitude toward the PLO as well. After the Lebanese Civil War broke out in 1975, turning Beirut into a war zone, Salome posted his own men to guard the American embassy. The Israelis looked on and ground their teeth. The link with Salome was not Ames's private initiative or a rogue operation, although the American did have sharply critical positions toward Israel. It, in fact, was a high-priority project of the entire CIA. In late 1976, the agency's director, George H.W. Bush, sent an official invitation to Salome, via Ames, to come to Langley. The visit, which took place in January 1977, combined business and pleasure. Salome told Ames that he really needed a vacation. He had just married a former Miss Universe, the Lebanese beauty queen Georgina Rizk, and wanted to make her dream come true of having their honeymoon in Hawaii and Disneyland. Ames promised to take care of it. The CIA organized the trip, and a senior official escorted the couple wherever they went, including on all the rides in the California theme park. Rizk greatly enjoyed herself. Salome hated Disneyland, but was very happy with the gift he received from CIA Operations Officer Alan Wolf, a splendid leather shoulder holster for his handgun. The CIA escort, Charles Waverly, recalled the visit. All he, Salome, really wanted to do was eat oysters. He thought they were an aphrodisiac. I was in the adjoining hotel room, so in the evenings, I heard the results. Because of the relationship between the Israeli and American intelligence communities and Israel's overall dependence on the United States, the Mossad refrained from operating on American soil. Salome knew he wasn't threatened there. This meant that the couple could have a real holiday without bodyguards getting in the way. Normally, however, Salome hardly ever left Beirut, and he surrounded himself with very heavy security. He would move around in a convoy of vehicles loaded with armed bodyguards, with a Dushka 22mm heavy machine gun mounted on a Toyota pickup truck, bringing up the rear. Ames and his CIA colleague were not impressed. In his book, Byrd mentions that Sam Wyman, one of the CIA liaison officers with Salome in Beirut, once asked Salome, "How is that damn cannon going to protect you? It just announces to everyone where you are." Salome just laughed and said, "Oh, it is good." Byrd notes that Salome was given dozens of CIA alerts, some in a very firm tone, that the Mossad was out to get him. "I warned him," said Wyman. "I told him, 'You idiot, they're going to get you the way you drive around Beirut. It is only a matter of time. You are violating every principle of good intelligence practice. The Israelis know who you are, and they know what you did. And so you should be careful." The CIA even supplied Salome with encrypted communications equipment to enhance his security, and it considered sending Salome an armor-plated car to protect him from the Israelis as well. To Dominic, there was only one way this relationship could be interpreted. Imagine that we, the Mossad, set up a secret relationship with Osama bin Laden, not because we recruited him as a spy working for cash, but a friendly relationship. Almost like allies, swapping info on mutual favors. Imagine that we invited him on a visit to our Tel Aviv headquarters, kowtowed to him, expressed understanding and sympathy for the Twin Towers attack, told him that it was okay for him to go on blasting American embassies as long as he didn't blast ours, gave him and his wife royal hospitality, and did everything to protect him from the Navy SEALs coming to kill him. How would that be seen by America? The Mossad eventually reached the conclusion that cutting this channel was very important, to show that no one was immune, and also to give the Americans a hint that this was no way to behave toward friends. Prime Minister Begin was informed by Mossad Director Hoffi about the relationship between Salameh and the Americans. But even with this knowledge, he accepted the Mossad's recommendation to assassinate him. In June 1978, 3 months after Wadi Hadad was killed, Operation Maver, Burner, the hunt for Salameh, went into high gear. For the first time since Operation Spring of Youth, Kisaraya would kill someone in a target country. A blue and white job to ensure that the job will be done, in Harari's words. A top agent for Amman's Unit 504, codenamed Rumenege, after a German soccer star of the time, was asked to supply information about the quarry's habits. Rumenege was Amin al-Haj, a member of one of Lebanon's prominent Shiite families and a well-connected merchant. His recruitment was facilitated by his hatred of the Palestinians and his desire to obtain permission to move his goods, which some say included a lot of illicit drugs, freely around the Middle East, sometimes via Israel, without hindrance by the Israeli Navy. Meetings between Rumenige and his controller were usually held on an Israeli missile boat off the coast of Lebanon. Al-Haj used his network of sources to come up with a plethora of details on Salameh's daily routines, discovering that he spent a lot of time at the gym and spa of the Continental Hotel in Beirut, and that he shared an apartment with Rizk in the upscale Snobra neighborhood of the city. Harari was pleased. Salameh was by nature a playboy, a prominent figure in Beirut's glitzy social class, he said. It's easy to get close up in such circles. I sent my warriors in to rub shoulders with him. A Kisaraya operative went to Beirut, booked a room in the Continental Hotel under a false European identity, and signed up at the gym. He went there every day, and now and again he ran into Salameh. He knew Salameh took a keen interest in luxury watches and fashionable clothes, and he dressed himself accordingly in the locker room, always standing as close as he could get to the Palestinian. One day, some of the other gym members were congratulating Salameh on an award Rizk had received at a ball the previous night. The Kisaraya operative joined in and struck up a conversation with Salameh. "There was some male bonding there," said Harari. The two became friendly and chatted every now and again. The idea in encounters like these is to let the target initiate contact, said a source involved in the operation. Otherwise, it would seem suspicious, especially for a hunted person like Salameh. When the Kisaraya operative returned to Israel, a low signature hit on Salameh was discussed, including the possibility of slipping some medicine into his toothpaste or soap or aftershave lotion, Harari said. But the risk for the operative, were he to be discovered, looked too great. Another alternative, placing an explosive device in Salameh's locker at the gym, was rejected out of fear that an innocent bystander might also be hurt. Eventually, Harari decided to drop altogether the idea of taking him out at the gym or his office or home because of the heavy security at those sites. The solution Harari adopted was new to the Mossad. A bomb on a public street, hitting a moving target. Salameh would be dispatched while driving through Beirut, escorted by the Toyota truck with a heavy machine gun and a third vehicle occupied by bodyguards. Somewhere along the route, as the three cars passed by, a large explosive device would be triggered by a Mossad operative positioned unobtrusively a safe distance away. Yaakov Rehavi, a former NASA scientist recruited by the Mossad to head the technology department, created a special device for the agents to practice executing the operation. In the drill, the operator had to push a button at the exact moment a car chassis on metal wheels, towed at speed by another vehicle, passed a certain point. There was no explosion, just an electronic signal showing whether the button had been precisely synchronized with the passing of the vehicle. Agents who took part in the drills recalled that Rehavi and two other male operatives couldn't get the timing right. "Maybe you'll let me try," asked a female desk hand in the counterterror department, who was present at the drills. Rehavi smiled patronizingly and handed her the remote. She timed it perfectly, several drills in a row. Finally, they tried it with explosives, with store window mannequins in the car, and once again, the woman's timing was perfect. "As long as men were pushing the button, there was an atmosphere of despair," said Harari. "But after she aced it again and again, in differing light conditions, I realized that women apparently were better at it than men, and I made a decision accordingly." A female operative, codenamed Rina, would push the button in Beirut. "This wasn't an easy decision," said Harari. "We had to change all the cover stories and to construct something that would suit a woman who would possibly have to remain for long hours at a site with a view of the street. It wasn't enough for her just to know how to push the button. Salome didn't leave his home at the same times every day. Sometimes it was necessary to be on the alert for as much as 18 hours, and sometimes she'd have to close her eyes or go and do pee-pee. It's no simple matter." Rina's real name was Erica Chambers, and she was born in England in 1948, the daughter of Marcus Chambers, an engineer who designed race cars and spent most of his life at the tracks, and his wife, Lona, a singer and actress from a wealthy Czechoslovakian Jewish family, most of whom were killed in the Holocaust. Erica studied at the University of Southampton in the 1960s, where she was remembered most vividly for her wild driving. She traveled to Australia and then to Israel, where she enrolled in a master's program in hydrology at the Hebrew University. In early 1973, she was contacted by a recruiter for the Mossad. She liked the idea of combining adventure with what she described as making a significant contribution to the security of the state. She passed all of the screening tests, was inducted into Caesarea, and then underwent the grueling training program. In mid-1975, she left Israel, assumed a false British identity, and began carrying out missions abroad. Rina and two men were selected for the assassination of Salome. The complex plan once again called for close cooperation with the IDF's special ops units, who were to execute those aspects of the operation that the Mossad couldn't carry out itself. Rina arrived in Beirut in October 1978, presenting herself as an NGO staffer interested in assisting Palestinian orphans at a shelter in the Tel el-Zatar refugee camp. She lived in the city for some 2 months and, together with another operative, clandestinely gathered information about Salome's movements. Early in the new year, she rented a flat on the 8th floor of a high-rise building on Becca Street, overlooking Salome's apartment. On January 16, the other two operatives arrived in Beirut separately, one with a British passport and the other with a Canadian one. On January 18, a team from Seret Matkal crossed the border into Jordan, in the Araba region, south of the Dead Sea, carrying 100 kilograms of plastic explosive and a detonation device. On the other side of the border, a 504 agent was waiting. He put the explosives in his car and drove to Beirut. On January 19, in an underground parking garage, he met the two male operatives. He said the password, two words in English, and they gave the prearranged two-word reply. The agent then handed over the explosives and the detonation device, said goodbye, and left. His part in the operation was done. The operatives loaded the bomb into the trunk of a Volkswagen they had rented 2 days before, set the detonation device, and parked the car down the street from Salome's apartment block. Harari himself traveled to Beirut to oversee the culmination of Operation Maver. He could not allow himself another failure like Lilhammer. Leaving the Volkswagen containing the bomb parked on a busy street for what might be a long time was a problem. A parking inspector's suspicion could be aroused. The solution? To switch cars, at a time when we were sure that Salome would not be passing, just making sure we kept the right parking spot was an operation in itself. On January 21, 1979, Harari took leave of Rina and the two men and flew out, to ensure that there would be as few operatives as possible in the field. The next day, shortly after 3 p.m., Salome finished eating lunch with his wife, kissed her goodbye, and left. He got into his Chevrolet and drove off at 3:23 toward the 417 offices, his bodyguards traveling in the Land Rover in front of him and the Toyota behind him. He had gone only about 60 feet when his Chevy drew level with the Volkswagen. Rina pressed the button. A huge explosion shook Beirut, and the Chevrolet became a ball of fire. One of the two male operatives, who was watching from a distance, would later recount to his friends that Salome had managed to get out of the car, his clothes in flames, and fall to the ground. The operative muttered through his teeth, "Die, motherfucker, die." Abu Daoud, Mohammed Udeh, the commander of Black September's Munich operation, who by chance was passing by, ran up and tried to help. He saw a huge metal fragment lodged in Salome's skull. Salome was rushed to the American University Hospital, where he died on the operating table. Eight others were also killed in the blast. Salome's driver and two bodyguards, three Lebanese citizens, a German, and a Briton. Hariri acknowledged that an operation such as this, with the explosion of a large device in an area teeming with passers-by, would never have been approved in a non-Arab country. Rina and the other two operatives waited on a beach near Junia, north of Beirut, for a rubber dinghy manned by Flotilla 13 men to pick them up at around midnight. A young naval commando lifted Rina into the boat. The man, on one of his first missions, was Holiday, who would one day become head of Caesarea. The dinghy met up with a Navy missile boat waiting out at sea, and within hours, the hit team was in Haifa. The killing of Salome was a terrible blow to the PLO. "I warned them," Arafat exclaimed, with heavy pathos, in a television interview shortly afterward. "I warned my brothers, be careful. The Mossad will hunt us one by one, commander by commander." At Salome's huge funeral, Arafat took Hassan, the dead man's son, who was named after his grandfather, the Palestinian commander in the 1948 war, on his knee, holding an AK-47, just as he had held Ali himself at a memorial for his father 25 years before. Frank Anderson, head of the CIA station in Beirut, wrote Hassan an emotional condolence letter. "At your age, I lost my father. Today, I lost a friend whom I respected more than other men. I promise to honor your father's memory and to stand ready to be your friend." Israel had closed its account with Ali Salome, but it had not managed to cut the ties between the United States and the PLO. Robert Ames was very saddened by the death of his friend, and he tried hard to forge ties with the man the PLO appointed to replace him, Hani al-Hassan. After the slaying, Ames espoused positions that were considered pro-Palestinian, and he was a key figure in the formulation of the Reagan Plan, which was, in effect, the first official American recognition of the right of the Palestinians to establish a state of their own. Chapter 14. A Pack of Wild Dogs. About a week before Wadi Haddad, writhing in agony from Mossad poison, was admitted to an East German hospital, the Shin Bet learned from one of its sources, codenamed Housemaid, about a PLO squad training for a raid into Israel. Imus Gilad, from the Amman unit that dealt with Palestinian terrorism, met Housemaid in the Shin Bet safe house in Jerusalem and left the meeting feeling very worried. "I understood they were planning something terrible, and they wanted to cause as many casualties as possible." The information, confirmed by wiretaps at the PLO offices in Cyprus, was very specific. The Shin Bet knew the names of the terrorists and the exact location of their base on the beach of Damour in Lebanon. They knew that the terrorists were planning an attack from the sea, and that the assault was intended to disrupt peace talks Begin had initiated with Egypt. Arafat and Abu Jihad had ordered it because they feared, correctly, that a truce between Egypt and Israel would leave the Palestinians in the lurch, as Egypt had thus far been their chief advocate. The raid was so important to the PLO that Abu Jihad himself had briefed the guerrillas, together with his operations commander in Lebanon, Azmi Zerer. Gilad wanted to strike first, to eliminate the threat with a preemptive attack on the terrorist base. On March 5, 1978, the Naval Commandos, Flotilla 13, carried out Operation Lucky Man, Bar Mazal. The aim was to eliminate all the terrorists at the Damour base, but they actually killed only those who were in one building, while those who were in a nearby structure and didn't come out or open fire were unharmed. Housemaid was able to report this as well. Gilad demanded that the commandos go in again to finish the job, but Defense Minister Ezer Weizmann said, "Forget about all these commando raids. I'm going to Washington tomorrow, and it'll only ruin my visit." Gilad protested vehemently. "By now, Abu Jihad knows that we know that he's preparing something that will only spur him on to get them on the move as soon as possible. There is going to be a murderous attack." Weizmann may have been correct that headlines about an Israeli military action in the sovereign territory of another country would cast a dark shadow over his first visit to the Pentagon as defense minister, but it turned out to be a costly decision. On March 11, 1978, at 2:30 p.m., 11 Fatah men landed on the beach near Kibbutz Magan Mikael, south of Haifa, in a nature preserve bounded by fish-breeding ponds, where flocks of migrant birds stop on their way to and from Africa. An American nature photographer named Gail Rubin was taking pictures of the birds when the raiding party stumbled upon her. The Palestinians were close to despair after three exhausting and hazardous days at sea, during which two of their number had drowned. Because the waters were so stormy and they had been washed miles out to sea, they had lost their bearings and thought they'd landed in Cyprus. They were relieved when Reuben told them they were in Israel, halfway between Haifa and Tel Aviv. They thanked her and shot her dead. Then the attackers made for the coastal highway, the road between Haifa and Tel Aviv. At gunpoint, they hijacked a taxi and then a bus and took the drivers and passengers hostage. They ordered the driver of the bus to head south toward Tel Aviv. Abu Jihad had instructed them to seize a hotel, but the raiders, now in bold high spirits because of the dozens of hostages in their hands, decided to change the nature of the operation. The IDF's classified report on what followed noted, "The terrorists' improvisation led to a new method of assault, an attack on the move, along a route of over 50 kilometers, which was a surprise and against which there was no deployment at all on the part of the security forces." The terrorists fired from the bus windows at vehicles on the road and stopped another bus, taking its passengers hostage as well. Because of the novel nature of the attack, security forces found it difficult to read the situation, to maintain an updated evaluation, and to take the initiative, which affected the course of the incident and its results. Although the police managed to stop the bus at the northern outskirts of Tel Aviv, the confusion led to utter chaos. The predominant factor was the lack of central control, both among the terrorists, who were trying to defend themselves by firing in all possible directions, and among the security forces. One of the terrorists rested the hand holding his pistol upon the head of the daughter of one of the hostages, Avraham Shamir. Shamir saw the man was wounded and he charged at him, grabbed his gun, and shot a terrorist standing at the front of the bus. Then he fired three shots at another terrorist. "Behind you," warned a female hostage, and Shamir turned to see one of the Arabs aiming his weapon at him. They both fired at the same time and wounded each other. The courageous Shamir, still functioning, saw that the man whose gun he had grabbed was lying on the floor, muttering, his face covered in blood. He had a grenade in his hand, the safety pin removed. Shamir tried to stop him from dropping it, but he failed, and the grenade rolled onto the floor. He tried to use the terrorist's body to block the blast, but that didn't work either. The grenade exploded, seriously wounding Shamir's eyes and killing the terrorist and five hostages. The blast set the bus on fire. Some of the terrorists and hostages managed to escape, but most were burned alive. In all, 35 Israelis, 13 of them children, were killed, and 71 were wounded. 9 of the terrorists died. One was captured at the scene, and another was found in a hospital where the casualties had been taken. "I see him lying there," said Aria Hadar, the top Shin Bet interrogator, lightly wounded but with a feeding tube and an IV infusion, mocking us right in our face. The doctor understood what was up and he turned his back to us and said, "You'll do what you do, and I'll do what I do." We pulled out the tubes. He screamed a little from pain and began talking right away. "Abu Jihad sent us," he said. The Coastal Road Massacre, as it became known in Israel, is one of a handful of terrorist attacks out of the thousands Israel has suffered that have been branded into the collective consciousness. Defense Minister Weizmann, full of remorse at having forbidden a preemptive attack, rushed home and ordered the IDF to launch a large-scale invasion of southern Lebanon, Operation Litani. 3 days after the massacre, Israeli armor and paratroops crossed into Lebanon with the goal of killing as many PLO fighters as they could, destroying their bases in southern Lebanon and pushing them north of the Litani River, some 15 miles north of the Israeli border. The incursion achieved only a few of its objectives. Some 300 PLO operatives were killed, their bases wrecked, and arms depots seized. In addition, a United Nations interim force in Lebanon, UNIFIL, was set up and posted in the area, and a pro-Israel, mainly Christian militia, the Free Lebanese Army, was established. But with time, even all of these new forces could not prevent the firing of Katyusha rockets at Israel, or cross-border penetrations by PLO squads. Due to the fury engendered by the slaughter of civilians, Israeli soldiers also committed a few acts of killing prisoners and of looting during the week-long Operation Litani. Once again, Israel sustained sharp international condemnation. Weizmann understood that large-scale operations in Lebanon were out of the question. Mossad operations, meanwhile, required months of preparation, figuring out how to get into a target state under a cover identity, execute a hit, and get out without being discovered. So Weizmann opted instead for precision raids and targeted killings by special forces units, less complicated, faster, and requiring no cover story, undertaken by commandos in full combat gear. The division selected to carry out most of these missions was the Naval Commando Unit, Flotilla 13. The man Weizmann put in charge of the operations in Lebanon was General Rafael Raful Eitan, who became Chief of Staff in April 1978. Eitan, a farmer and a carpenter, was a tough paratrooper who knew no fear during battle and a political hawk who believed in taking the war against the PLO to the enemy's rear to harass them at their staging bases. Eitan never saw himself bound by the rules of political correctness. Responding to rock throwing by Palestinians on the West Bank, he suggested to the Knesset that new Jewish settlements should be established there until the Arabs could only run around like drugged bugs in a bottle. One of his first moves as chief of staff was to pardon two convicted IDF criminals. Why, the POW interrogator under whose grilling a Palestinian terrorist suspect had died, and another, who was involved in the Nairobi plot, was hospitalized, as well as Lieutenant Daniel Pinto, who had tortured and murdered two prisoners during Operation Litani, throwing their bodies into a well. A bear-like man of very few words, Eitan addressed the naval commandos at their base at Adlit shortly after taking over as chief of staff. "You, Flotilla 13, are like a priest's balls," he said. "Not used, but it's nice that they're there." He paused for a moment and looked around to make sure everyone was smiling at his crude wisecrack. Then he became serious, cleared his throat, and delivered the main message. "All that is going to change." Flotilla 13 was founded in late 1949 as a secret commando unit responsible for clandestine penetration and sabotage and targeted killing operations via the sea. The motto selected by the founders fit this spirit. "Like a bat out of the dark, like a blade slicing in silence, like a grenade shattering with a roar." The unit's insignia is a bat's wings with the Israeli Navy emblem at the center. Its 18-month training program is as arduous as that of Sayeret Matkal, if not more so. Toward the end of it, recruits also undergo a hellish POW simulation. Between 1978 and 1980, Flotilla 13 carried out 23 raids against the PLO on Lebanese territory or at sea.